Hello and welcome to CJ Evolution, the podcast dedicated to helping criminal justice professionals like you. Now here's your host, fellow CJ Evolutionary, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back. Episode 198 of this great podcast we call CJ Evolution. Patrick here. I'm the host and creator of the show. Whatever you were doing, wherever you were at, thank you for spending a little bit of your valuable time with me. Special thanks to the brave men and women working in criminal justice all around the world. Thank you for what you do. Stay safe. If you're a first-time listener, welcome to the show. We hope you enjoy it. You can head over to cjevolution.com. That's the website, and check out all the episodes. They are on the website. And while you're there, you can click on the link to 4Sigmatic and get some amazing products. At 4Sigmatic, their mission is pretty simple. Make the everyday magic of functional mushrooms more easily accessible. They do this by incorporating functional mushrooms and superfoods into products you use every day, such as coffees, hot cocos, mocha, elixirs, and easy-to-mix blends. And you might be thinking, mushroom coffee. Yes, it is mushroom coffee, but it tastes amazing. If you click on the link to cjevolution.com and take you over to this amazing website for Sigmatic, you'll get 15% off of your purchases by using promo code CJEVO. You know, folks, we live in a digital age, and now more than ever, we need to protect our personal information. Cybersecurity is both applicable to both our personal and business lives. My next guest is an expert in cybersecurity. She's going to give you some good tips that you can use both personally and professionally. She's an amazing woman, and she has much experience in this arena. So enjoy the show. Very informative. And thank you for listening. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Very excited to have my next guest on. She's from across the pond in the UK. Lisa Forte is a cybersecurity trainer, international speaker and writer, and a penetration tester. And we're going to talk about all that. Welcome, Lisa.
Hello.
Hello. How's it going across the pond in the UK?
It's going quite well at the moment in the UK. I mean, we have a few little problems that are coming along, like the whole Brexit thing, which you may have heard about, is throwing a rather large spanner in the works, especially with regards to sort of policing and intelligence work. So it's all exciting and up in the air, which is interesting.
And you said that we were talking a little bit about off the show or before we went on air about the weather, and the weather's just not good right now, right? Or no, it is.
No, the weather is good, which is rather unusual for here. But it's really hot. So hot here is about 20 degrees. So everyone is sort of wearing shorts and getting really burnt. But that's kind of how we do it in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of stuff going on in the world. I want to talk about, I mean, obviously your expertise is in cybersecurity. And what is the UK and Europe's policing response to cybercrime?
It's really difficult to police cybercrime because, for a start, a lot of our legislation that we have over this side is actually a little bit antiquated and sort of was really developed in the 90s and now doesn't really deal very well with, you know, the changes and the fast progression of the cybercrime kind of sphere. And so in the UK, all our policing is effectively done to what we call the four P's. So we have prevent, which is sort of prevention of crime, prepare, which is sort of helping people prepare for what they would do if they became a victim of crime, protect, which is, you know, stopping yourself be a victim of crime, and then finally pursue, which is going after the bad guys. And my previous experience before going into cybercrime was working in counterterrorism intelligence, and we worked those four P's again in that, and that's sort of how we format everything.
Now, can you talk a little bit about your experience in counterterrorism?
Yeah, sure. So the UK kind of has very similar sort of international counterterrorism issues as I presume the US does, but we also have quite a lot of trouble with Northern Ireland terrorism, which obviously was massive, you know, 20, 30 years ago, but it's still sort of bubbling over, and also lots of domestic extremism issues as well. So given our proximity to Europe and the mass migration that we had from sort of Libya and those sorts of countries, we have seen, unfortunately, the last few years, quite a spike in terrorist activity in the UK and across Europe, actually. So, it's been quite difficult from that perspective.
I remember growing up hearing about the IRA, you know, growing up and hearing, and I guess you just don't, I mean, obviously it's still going on. Like you said, it's bubbling up, but you just don't hear about it, maybe because there's just so much else going on in the world. But yeah, you're right there. So I imagine, yeah, we just don't hear about it a lot over in the United States.
No, totally. It's one of those things that gets forgotten about, but you know, what with, you know, the tensions are sort of bubbling up again because of this Brexit scenario that we're having over here. Everyone is sort of speculating as to whether that will sort of make everything sort of boil over again. And so it's, yeah, something to keep an eye on, unfortunately.
Now, let me ask you this. You mentioned Libya, Lisa. Now, are you seeing Syrian refugees coming, you know, to the UK and because you know what's going on over in Syria?
Yeah, we've had a lot from Syria, Afghanistan, Somalia. And you know, 99.9% of them, you know, that's fine, no problem.
Sure.
But with the, you know, sort of increase with ISIS, we were seeing that actually they were managing to get people across, you know, purporting to be refugees, and getting into the country that way. And it's almost impossible to vet them coming across, because, you know, how do you go about doing that when they've come from another country and they're refugees and they've left everything? So it becomes a real challenge to kind of keep tabs on what's going on. That's definitely been a big challenge across Europe. And I think that will probably continue for a little while, what with everything going on in Syria.
And you talked about, you know, your experience in cybercrime, and you started your own company, Red Goat Cybersecurity, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Now, what is your specialty with that company?
So we focus heavily on sort of social engineering type of things. So we help companies around the world train their staff to recognize sort of malicious attempts at accessing the company, either physically or logically through computers. And we also have a team of people who are also ex-MI5, MI6, things like that, who basically try to break into companies and see how far we can actually get into the building before we're stopped by a security guard. So
that's
testing
the
their security that way.
That's the penetration testing part of it.
Sure, yeah. So it allows us to have a lot of fun legally.
Oh yeah, and then what do you do legally? And so, you know, it must be amazing, you know, to get the look on, you know, with your clients, you know, when you probably tell them, well, we got past this. And I imagine some companies are better with security than others, but there's probably those companies that they're just amazed how far you've gotten, you know, in their
systems.
Yeah,
definitely. I've been in boardrooms where the CEO has basically just had his head in his hands as I'm sort of telling them exactly what happened and how accommodating their staff were and things like that. So, it's sometimes quite satisfying in a way, though. But,
oh, sure.
You sort of also want to get stopped and not be allowed in, because that's obviously the end game, really.
Now, what is some of the biggest cyber threats out there, Lisa?
I think the biggest one in terms of the speed of growth has got to be sort of social engineering, because whilst lots of technical controls, so firewalls and things like that, get better and better and better, the return on investment for hackers is much better if they sort of work on the human. So phone them up or send them an email, phishing email or something like that. That's much easier to bypass the company's systems than it is to, you know, be really sort of clever and manage to do it that way. And I think the other thing we're seeing is a lot of sort of cyber attack as a service. So people just buying kits, which means that essentially you don't need to have lots and lots of technical knowledge. You can just purchase a kit, a ransomware kit, for example, and say, okay, I want to send it to these email addresses, and then off it goes. So the sort of barrier to entry is actually a lot lower than you'd think from watching things like Mr. Robot.
Now, can you tell us a little bit about social engineering for the people out there that are kind of scratching their head and saying, okay, what does that mean?
Yeah, so social engineering is effectively when you manipulate someone to do something or allow you to do something that they wouldn't normally do in the ordinary mm-hmm. course of things. So mm-hmm. you might, the obvious one is emailing someone pretending to be Amazon and saying, there's a massive problem with your account, please click on this link or something mm-hmm. like that. So it's just about, you know, attacking the human firewall as opposed to the actual firewall.
Yeah, and it always amazes me, and I'm sure it is too. I'm 49 years old, and I remember, in high school, dealing with like DOS and just basic stuff. And it always amazes me how far we've come technologically.
Yeah, definitely.
Last 30 years.
Yeah, no, totally. And I think it's a quite interesting sort of challenge, really, because not just from a cybercrime perspective, but for policing generally, mm-hmm. with the use of social media and everything, the amount of information that's actually out there, a lot of the intelligence gathering has sort of shifted from covert to quite sort of over open source stuff now, because people are putting it out there willingly, as opposed to, having to, in the old days, sort of tap phones and things like that. You don't need to do so much of that.
Now, what can the average person out there do? You probably get this question, because I know we get it, and I'm law enforcement here in the United States, and I imagine you have scams and stuff that are going on in the UK all the time.
Yes.
What can the average person do to keep their information more safe? Because like you said, some people, a lot of people will click on that link from Amazon. It's really not Amazon. So there's so many scams out there.
Yeah, there are a lot of scams out there. And I think, you've got sort of phishing attacks, which are, like I just said, with the Amazon or, your tax return or things like that are sent out to loads of people across the board, as opposed to targeting at specific individuals. And sometimes they're quite easy to spot. For instance, Amazon probably know your name. So if it says dear valued customer, chances are that's probably not Amazon. Mm-hmm. And just not clicking on links. So thinking, okay, Amazon said there's this problem, so I'm going to log into Amazon the way I always log into Amazon, as opposed to clicking on the link and then, sort of checking on it. But obviously the harder to spot ones are what we call spear phishing, which is where effectively they gather intelligence on you as an individual. Mm-hmm. And then they'll approach you. For instance, oh, Lisa, we heard that you were on this podcast the other day. It was really great. Please click on this link and just tell us, if you'd like to be on our podcast or something. Huh. And you're there increasing your chances of getting that person to click on the link because they think that they know you. So essentially, it's something that policing has always done, but now the bad guys are also doing it.
Yeah, and they're smart.
They're really smart.
They're not the dumb criminal. There are plenty of dumb criminals out there, but there are also some very, very sophisticated criminals out there as we're learning. Can you talk about the impact of the General Data Protection Regulation, which is coming into force throughout Europe in May and will impact U.S. organizations that collects any data on UA or EU nationals? Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Firstly, I love how you guys say it. We say data. So I actually really enjoy listening to you say it.
Data.
it's going to be a massive thing. I think so across the EU, this is like a massive, massive piece of legislation that's mm-hmm. Every EU national is going to be protected by it, which I think is unprecedented in the world to have such sort of draconian, far-reaching data protection laws. And essentially, it's a massive problem because lots of companies around the world have not really thought about data protection particularly seriously. Mm-hmm. And now they're going to have to spend an awful lot of money. So in the UK, we've seen lots of big companies just delete their mailing lists completely because they can't go back to every single person and ask for consent. So they just delete them and start again. And I think, I've spoken to a few companies in the US, and I think, they're genuinely quite concerned about some of the data they hold on EU nationals and thinking about maybe just deleting it entirely. So I think it's good in a way. We'll see how well it's policed, because that's always, mm-hmm. Kind of half of it, really.
Exactly.
But yeah, I think it's good to have those sort of, we've seen with Facebook and everything like that, I think, we need to start legislating a bit more stringently on protecting people's data. So I think that's a good step forward.
Can you talk about some, and we hit on it a little bit, Lisa, about some of the challenges with cybersecurity and some of the threats out there. What are some of the other security challenges out there for different industries?
So generally speaking, I'd say, you know, law firms and accountancy firms are particularly at risk, because what they tend to have is a lot of money, so they're quite cash rich, and they're also very, very data rich, and they hold data on lots and lots and lots of companies and individuals. So just from a point of view of return on investment in terms of your time, if you attack a law firm that's got 100 companies as their clients, effectively you can potentially get all of those 100 companies, as opposed to doing each one individually. So I think they're always a really massive target. The other thing that is unfortunate in a way with the cyber sector is that it tends to lend itself to being sensationalized a little bit. And so you see things like lots of stories about how ships can be hacked and, you know, driven to Somalia and blown up and all the rest of it. And the point is, we're just not seeing that happen. You know, hackers aren't blowing up nuclear power stations at the moment. They're not, you know, blowing up satellites. What's happening is that they don't have to do that, because at the moment they can attack your Windows machine in your office, and that's much easier than it is to try and learn how a satellite works. So I don't think we've got, as you know, and the US is included in this, I don't think we've got the basics right yet. So I think we need to stop worrying about these massive doomsday type scenarios and actually just get the basics right.
What is the difference between, I just thought about this, a threat, vulnerability, and a risk?
So a vulnerability is something that perhaps would enable an attacker to get into a system or into a building. So it might, for example, in the physical space, it might be an unlocked door. So the door, the external door to your building, isn't locked, which might be a vulnerability to allow a threat, the person coming in, to be realized. And then the risk is just basically looking at the likelihood that someone, the threat, will exploit the vulnerability effectively. So, you know, it might be that actually you've got a massive perimeter fence around your building, so the chances are they can't probably get through that door anyway. So, you know, the risk would therefore be quite low.
So what should cybersecurity professionals be focusing on, threats or vulnerabilities?
I think, personally, I think vulnerabilities, because my personal feeling is, with everything, and this includes physical security as well, is you need to assess what's first of all, assess what are you trying to protect, what are my assets, what are really valuable to me, and then look at the vulnerabilities surrounding those and how you start to protect them, as opposed to focusing on all the other things that are going on, because actually there might be some threats out there that you're not actually vulnerable to, so there's no point focusing on them.
Yeah, that's a good point. What were some of the challenges working for, you know, the UK in terms of policing when you were with them?
I think the biggest challenge facing UK policing is funding. It's a massive, massive problem. And each sort of parliamentary term, funding gets cut more and more. We've also, I don't know, you know, we don't have gun violence particularly. It's not really a problem at all, thankfully, in the UK. But we do have an awful lot of knife crime and acid crime as well, which, you know, we see. I don't know if you've read about it in your media, hopefully not. But we had quite a long period where, especially in our capital, young individuals were driving around on scooters throwing very concentrated acid at people's faces, which was very unpleasant. So, we have a lot of that. And I think in the UK, we're very, very paranoid about physical crime, probably disproportionately so. But yeah, have no paranoia whatsoever about cybercrime, which is why we're very, very vulnerable to that sort of thing. We've just had a new sort of movement in the UK where now all our police officers wear body-worn cameras, which I think is a really good step forward for a lot of things as well. So hopefully that will start to improve things. But we also don't have a lot of public support for the law enforcement. I'm not sure how it works in the United States, but in the UK, there's quite a sort of image issue with it. So
I wonder why that is. I mean, because modern day policing, I mean, you probably know this, Lisa, was born in the UK. You know, we basically took the model from Robert Peel, you know, in the UK, and we basically brought it over to the United States. So I'm just wondering why the image of the policing is a little bit, you know, is, I mean, I know it's kind of ebbs and flow, you know, it's kind of up and down in the United States, but I'm kind of surprised that, you know, there is a kind of a negative image of police in England. I guess that's not, well, I guess it could be anywhere, but.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can actually answer that. I just, it is a problem getting public support for a lot of things that happen. Hmm. And maybe that's a problem everywhere. I'm not sure how it works in the United States, but it is difficult. And I think because of the funding cuts that have happened over here, what's ended up happening is police forces have started sort of filling those roles with volunteers to kind of compensate. And I think that is potentially problematic because those volunteers don't get the same level of training as the other officers. So I think that might end up actually backfiring in the long term, potentially.
Sure. Let me ask you a question. You brought up there's not a lot of gun violence in the UK, but the police have access to weapons if they need them. You know, they can get
only very small numbers of police. So you'd have to be an armed officer, because I would say 95% of our officers are not armed or don't have access to any weapons at all.
Wow. Now, what do you think? What's your opinion? And I don't want to get into a gun issue, but just because, I mean, what do you think about looking? And you're not going to offend me either way, but looking at the U.S. and I mean, you hear the news over there about all these shootings, these mass shootings, and you know, it's appalling to me. I just don't know what your take is, and people you associate with, and you probably have friends in law enforcement. What are they just looking at us going, my God, what is going on over there? Because we ask the same thing.
I think there's two parts of it. I mean, for a start, our media, you know, sensationalize it probably undoubtedly quite a lot, which is quite alien to us anyway, because we've never had gun issues really in the UK. You know, we don't have that kind of violence. It's, you know, makes headline news if anyone even attempts to shoot somebody with a gun. Mm-hmm. So it's quite rare. But I also kind of feel a bit sorry for the armed officers in the US as well, because it sort of seems to me that the kind of split second decision making that has to happen sometimes when you make even, you know, like a traffic stop or anything like that, which in the UK is a very, very low risk maneuver, really, because you know they're very unlikely to be armed. It must be very difficult, because in the UK, you know, we've had only one or two situations where police have killed someone where it might not have, you know, the merits of it may not have been as clear as they thought at the time. And as a result of that, it's almost impossible to recruit armed police in the UK. They have a real, real difficulty getting anyone to sign up. And I think, well, you know, that must be quite a difficult challenge for police in the US.
You know, it is and it isn't. I mean, it depends on where you're at, too. So, I mean, we get, you know, a lot of, and I think the public, we went through a couple of years where the image of law enforcement was kind of down low, but I think we're coming back, Lisa, and you know, we have a lot of crime in the United States, but we, in my particular department, we don't have a problem, you know, recruiting people. You know, there's still a lot of people that want to become, you know, police officers, but there's, you know, we've seen it going down over the years just because of the attention and, you know, the liability and things like that. But
yeah, that's one of the problems we have over here, but I guess that's because we don't have armed officers across the board. So people think, well, I want to be a police officer, but there's no way I'm going to be one of the armed police officers. So,
what were some of the challenges? And I know you left, you know, the police work to start your own business. And we talk a lot about entrepreneurship on the show, and you went out and did it and you started your own company, a successful company. What were the pros and cons of doing so?
I think it was quite a scary move. I won't lie, but I think actually, as people who've worked in law enforcement, our experiences are some that regular sort of civilians just haven't had. So it actually means that you're incredibly valuable to the private sector, and I think it's just about realizing how best to sell those skills. because actually they are there. And, you know, it's the same in the US as it is worldwide. You know, we do have experiences that really shape us as individuals mm-hmm. that we're actually quite fortunate to have, even if at the time they're quite negative experiences. Mm-hmm. I think the culture in the private sector is quite different. And the rules of engagement are not quite as clearly defined as perhaps they would be. Mm-hmm. In the public sector, where you sort of feel like you know where you stand mm-hmm. A little bit more. But it's incredibly rewarding. And I really, really enjoy every day, really. But, you know, running your own business is a sort of 7-day-a-week job as as opposed to 5 days. So, yeah, prepare yourself for a lot more working time.
But it can be very lucrative and satisfying, right?
Definitely.
But you gotta, and I always tell people, and you know this because you did it, Lisa, is, you know, sooner or later, I'm going to get out of law enforcement. Everybody out there who's listening is going to get out of the business, whatever you're doing in criminal justice. And we're living longer, right? And so we're going to look for different careers, right? And so you got to take that chance with starting your own business and going out on your own. I mean, you know, we're only here for a certain amount of time, I guess.
Definitely, yeah. And I think you've just got to take the opportunities when you find them. I mean, when I started my business, I thought, okay, I'm going to, you know, work for businesses in the kind of area of the UK where I am. And then week two, I ended up in China and I was speaking at a big conference there and, you know, meeting lots of, you know, having clients and things like that. And you've just kind of got to go with it a little bit. And as the opportunities come, just keep sort of accepting them and sure. Don't be too stuck in your ways. I think that's sort of the best advice I could kind of give anybody at the moment.
So when you started, I mean, were you used, because you said you were speaking in front of big conferences, I mean, obviously you were probably nervous, right? I mean, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I'm Italian, so I'm a little bit kind of sure of myself, maybe more than I should be. But yeah, no, it was really weird. And because I speak around the world, the cultures are just so different when people are listening to you.
Sure.
You go from, you know, in China, for instance, everybody was sort of writing down every word I said.
Yeah.
And then after the day after the conference, someone emailed me and they said, oh, at the end, you sort of gave some reading that you said we should go away and do. I've done all of that. Where's the next set of reading? And I was thinking, this is so strange. In the UK, no one would ever do that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's all really different depending on which country you're in. So, yeah, it's exciting. I really enjoy doing it. And I think as ex-law enforcement people, yeah. You've got some really rich experiences that can be motivational or anything. And people really, you know, value that. So I mm-hmm. think it's again, about sort of tapping into those experiences and making the most of them.
So what's next for you, Lisa? I mean, you got maybe a book or are you just happy with what you're doing? Because, I mean, you've got so much experience.
I've always sort of toyed with the idea of writing a book, but you know mm-hmm. what? It's the editing. I just don't think I could do it.
Well, you can get somebody else to do it for you.
Yeah, that's very true. I could do that. I'm quite happy with what I'm doing at the moment. Mm-hmm. I just want to sort of consolidate things, grow the company, and I'll actually be coming to the US at the end of the year to do some speaking at some conferences. So I'm quite excited about that because
where were you going to be?
Go to Washington. So
oh, you get to go
I'm
to
excited.
Washington. Okay, cool.
Yes, I'm very excited about that.
Well, and if people want to reach out to you, Lisa, how can they do it?
You can do that on Twitter. We're at Red Goat Cyber is our handle. Alternatively, I'm on LinkedIn, Lisa Forte. You know, reach out to me. Any questions at all, I really don't mind. Just fire away, and anywhere I can help, I will.
Well, Lisa Forte, I thank you so much for being here, ma'am. It was a pleasure talking to you, and we wish you much success in the future. And you're always welcome back on the show.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
All right, Lisa. Have a good night.
Thanks for listening to CJ Evolution. Be sure to head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast and reach out to Patrick on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Anchor, or Snapchat. We'll see you next time on CJ Evolution.